wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be stuck.
You are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM in Hudson, New York, and this is the Prison Voices Project. I am your host this morning, Karanja K. Takaro. Today is Thursday, January 8th, 2015. For our first show of the year, we will be covering highlights and takeaways from 2014, including clips from our January 23rd show on parole justice, excerpts from the May 5th Albany rally for prison justice, and a portion of our July 10th interview with Deborah Small, Executive Director of Break the Chains. We will also have musical selections from D'Angelo, De La Soul, Chuck D, and Lauryn Hill. A special thanks to Emily Truitt and Allison McKim for assistance with selecting the content for today's show. We will begin with 1,000 Deaths by D'Angelo and the Vanguard.
With Jesus, when I say Jesus, I'm not talking about
Yeah.
Good morning again. I am your host this morning, Karanja K. DeCaro. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM in Hudson, New York, and this is the Prison Voices Project. Our first highlight comes from our January 23rd show on parole justice. Host Corey Fisher-Hoffman shared with our listeners an important exhibit installed in Albany on experiences with repeated denial of parole in New York State. Let's go to Corey now.
Play a segment now that is based on or is covering a recent action that took place at the Capitol just 2 days ago in Albany as a part of the ongoing struggle to fight for the New York Safe Parole Act, which is a piece of legislation that could offer incredible changes to the parole system that will mean real differences in people's lives, those who are facing parole and their family members who await their return. So here is a short segment that I produced on the continuing struggle for the New York State Parole Act and all of the incredible grassroots groups that are coming together and really hoping that this is the legislative season that these changes take place. Here you go.
Milk Knot Jails, the Center for Law and Justice, New York State Prisoner Justice Network, Capital Area Against Mass Incarceration, and NY Inside Out delivered and installed an exhibit of over 100 letters from people in prison and their families recounting their experience with a repeated denial of parole in New York State. The letters, each of which details a person's personal journey towards redemption, paints a tragic picture of the state's parole system and proposes a clear solution. The Safe and Fair Evaluations Safe Parole Act.
My name is Lauren Melodia, and I'm here today in the legislative office building at the Capitol with an installation of over 100 letters from people in prison about their experience with parole denial. And we've been meeting with a lot of state legislators for years on this issue, and we stop by their offices and tell them that we're here to represent a bunch of voices of people on the inside who have been routinely denied parole, and they shake our hands and smile and close the door. And so we wanted to really bring those voices with us today, so we figured we'd bring the letters here directly for them to look at themselves and see just how many people are experiencing the same problem over and over again.
The 6-foot-tall installation was a towering visual display of a small fraction of the stories of people in prison who are denied parole again and again with little feedback on how to rehabilitate themselves for release. Visitors to the installation flipped through the handwritten letters to read the stories of men and women who have spent decades in prison and their thoughtful reflections on justice, accountability, and redemption. One letter read, "I have been denied parole 10 times because of an unchangeable event, the nature of the crime. I was told at one of my hearings that you are a perfect candidate for parole, but my hands are tied. I cannot change yesterday. However, I can and did change myself." Another letter read, "It is truly a discouraging process because we don't know what else to do except time." Milk Knot Jails installed this one-day exhibit in the first month of the 2014 legislative session to educate legislators about the damaging effects of the current parole system. Judith Brink from Prison Action Network joined in the day of action.
We're here at the Milk Knot Jails installation. We think installations are a great way to go. They get a lot of public attention from people who wouldn't know about this stuff otherwise. I think the average citizen would think that the parole board should be evaluating people at their minimum, when they've completed their minimum sentence, and decide whether they're ready to come back to safety without us having to be afraid of them. But that's not what they do. What they do is decide how many years they should spend in prison, even though a judge long ago, 20 years ago in some cases, has decided was the appropriate punishment for the crime.
Naomi Jaffe of the New York State Prisoner Justice Network and Capital Area Against Mass Incarceration.
New York State Prisoner Justice Network was founded 5 years ago, and from the beginning we were really strong supporters of major changes in parole policy because we were in correspondence with people in prison and it was at the top of their priorities as one of the gravest injustices in the system.
The Safe and Fair Evaluations Parole Act would fundamentally reform the parole process by increasing parole board accountability and empowering people in prison to prepare for parole. Some of the legislation's proposed changes include 1. Removing the nature of the crime as a determining factor for parole decisions. 2. Making parole hearings take place in person as opposed to being run through a video link. And 3. Giving people who face the parole board access to their files so that they understand the criteria by which the parole board is basing their decisions. In the face of mass incarceration, parole justice is a key step towards reducing the high rates of incarceration in the United States. The Center for Law and Justice also does work to end mass incarceration in the Capital Region. They are currently circulating a petition to demand a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that examines the impacts of mass incarceration.
My name is Darrell Johnson. I'm with the Center of Law and Justice. We incarcerate too many people. And in any given day, it's 2.3 million prisoners allowed in the United States. What we want to do is take a look at that and reduce that number.
The issue of mass incarceration in general, as a social justice and particularly a racial justice issue, has emerged into the light of public dialogue. It was completely invisible 5 years ago when we started. So this is a very exciting moment when there is a lot of visibility and a lot of motion, the beginnings of realizations of the incredible racial disparities in the criminal justice system. Parole is one of a number of very serious issues. The people in prison told us that it was one of the most frustrating and upsetting of the injustices because there's no exit route. The parole board denies you over and over again based on your original crime, regardless of what you do. And to be in that situation of being in prison for decades with no way out is a level of torture that's unimaginable to people that haven't experienced it. So we are much in favor of the Safe Parole Act, which would be a major step in improving the situation because it does not allow the parole board to resentence you based on your original crime and forces the parole board to evaluate the people who come before it on the basis of what they've done since they've been in prison, on the basis of their readiness for reentry into the community.
That was Naomi Jaffe. The Safe Parole Act requires the parole board to give rejected applicants specific goals to meet in order to qualify for parole in future applications. The board is not currently required to give any guidance to people in prison whose parole applications they reject. The New York Safe Parole Act has received broad support in the state assembly for over 3 years, but it has yet to receive enough support in the state Senate to be discussed on the Senate floor. Lauren Melodia from Milk Not Jails.
We're hoping that if we just keep showing up with more and more voices and letters of support, that they might actually step in a little bit closer and read some of these personal stories, get to know some of the people who are maybe locked up in their districts who don't have an opportunity to be here directly. And perhaps that'll convince them that they should take some of these issues more seriously this year.
Following the December hearing on parole in the New York State Assembly's Committee of Corrections, in combination with a growing coalition of groups organizing to end mass incarceration and fight for parole justice, it seems as though this may be the session to bring about the long-needed reforms to the New York State's parole system.
Everybody is just so hopeful for this year, and a part of me wants to, you know, fan their hope, because I think hope is such a wonderful thing. But on the other hand, I know passing this legislation is not going to be easy.
That was Judith Brink. Her enthusiasm and caution was also shared by Naomi Jaffe of New York State Prisoner Justice Network.
One thing that I do want to say, particularly to listeners who are in prison, is that our organizations really want to not promise more than is possible in this atmosphere. There's a lot of support for parole reform. There's a lot of energy and a lot of visibility, but the obstacles are also very, very formidable. There's a lot of backlash from law enforcement, from the from politicians. We will keep at it as long as necessary. There's a more favorable climate than we've had before. The people who are on the other side of this are also very, very strong, and it's not going to be fast. It's not going to be easy. We are going to stay with it till it happens.
For the Prison Voices Project and WGXC, I am Corey Fisher Hoffman, reporting from the Legislative Office Building in Albany, New York.
And that was our excerpt on parole justice. On May 5th, 2014, in Albany, New York, protesters joined together for a rally, march, and day of action in support for prison justice. Here are a few of the highlights from the day.
Here today are people from across the state who are working on multiple issues. And the reason we're here unified is we understand two things. We understand, one, that the criminal justice system needs to be dismantled. But two, we are intelligent and we're not going to turn our backs to reforms that might provide relief to people who are behind those walls right now today.
If the risk is low, let them go. If the risk is low, let them go. If the risk is low, let them go. And that's what release agent persons in prison is all about.
We ask you to support establishment of the Safe Parole Act. We want our mothers and fathers home. We want our children home. Parole reform now.
We have to push to end the war on drugs. We are calling for the establishment of a Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission. The time is now.
More education and less incarceration.
Remove all barriers to higher education for all people, because education is a human right.
Domestic violence destroys family. So support the Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act bill.
And we say pass this Halt Solitary Confinement Act. We say pass this legislation for change and halt solitary confinement.
I recognize all the efforts to reform in the justice system to make it more humane. This is part of the struggle. But this system has got to go.
When you hold hands together, when you're organized, bring your organization with somebody else's organization. We fighting for not one organization. We fighting for a cause. It's called justice. It's called fairness. It's called equality. And in the end, it's called radical democracy.
And those were a few of the highlights from the May 5th rally for prison justice held in Albany, New York. And we ended with a very small excerpt from Cornel West. However, that's not all that we will hear from Cornel, because he, in fact, was the keynote speaker.
We are going to turn to our feature speech by Cornel West, which he gave at the Capitol building at the rally for New Yorkers Against Incarceration Injustice. And he's introduced in this segment by Albany's own Victoria Reyes of the Social Justice Center and the New York Prisoner Justice Network. So here is Victoria Reyes introducing the great Cornel West on the Prison Voices Project, WGXC 90.7 FM.
As a scholar and activist myself, I understand that the divide between the scholar and community organizer is sometimes quite vast. The campus activists and the community activists are oftentimes very far apart in terms of political awareness, issue focus, and commitments to a cause. While this divide has always existed somewhat, there was a time when it wasn't so pronounced. I was born from the generation that found its way to the college campus, overcoming numerous obstacles, only to return to its communities to protest, sit in, and fight for justice. My parents arrived on a college campus in the early 70s, lost. My father in particular, as he was a formerly incarcerated individual, unaware of both the political nature of their lives' misfortunes and the cultural framework of the campus environment. They were received by radical professors who taught them about Frantz Fanon, and taught them about Paulo Freire, and taught them about Zora Neale Hurston. And this is where Cornel West comes in. He stands as a reminder that the radical scholar still exists. And not only does the radical scholar exist, but the radical scholar plays an important role in our community activism. Because when we send our children from our communities up to the college campus in hopes that they will learn something and have an easier life than we've had, we need them to be received by radical professors who understand the community, are born from it, and are keenly aware of our needs both politically and spiritually. Today, Cornel West is the embodiment of these principles. The radical educator, unafraid to speak truth to power, unafraid to call out the first black president when he has failed to focus on the needs of his community, and unafraid to remain a voice of dissent in a world that begs for complacency. As we stand here today, challenging the criminal injustice system, calling out the torturous and humane prison system, fighting the signature domestic human rights issue of our times, we need an interconnected dialogue between our scholars and activists now more than ever. With that in mind, it is my honor to present to you, in the scholarly activist tradition of James Baldwin, June Jordan, Gloria Saldúa, and our own Barbara Smith, the professor of philosophy and Christian practice at Union Theological Seminary in New York City, scholar and community activist, the King of Love, Cornel West.
For Brother Victoria, Victoria, our dear brother, Brother Colin, too, Sister Suzanne, too, standing right next to Barbara Smith. Let me say, I would not want to be in any other place than this spot to stand with you to let the world know that we gonna stay in contact with the humanity of our brothers and sisters who are disproportionately chocolate, but whatever color they are, we stand with them no matter what the system has to say. Oh, yeah. We come with the spirit of John Coltrane. It's a love supreme. It's a love supreme. And when you love folk, you can't stand the fact they're being treated unjustly. You loathe the fact that they're being treated unfairly. And if we don't do something, the rocks are gonna shot out. That's why we're here. We're here to straighten our backs up and let the world know, let the system know, let these folk in this house, the White House, City Hall, anywhere in the nation, that when it comes to the Jim Crow Jr., the new Jim Crow system, we say it is a crime against humanity. That's what it is. Solitary confinement is torture. That's a crime against humanity. To lock folk up when 60% of them are there for soft drugs, and everybody knows 12% of those on the chocolate side, 12% of those on the vanilla side are flying high in the friendly skies every week taking drugs, but 65% of the convictions are chocolate. That just lets us know that the legacy of white supremacy is still operating in America. Oh, yes. But it's not just that, but it's also a class issue. Everybody knows that if not just our precious white and vanilla brothers and sisters, but if middle-class young folk of any color were going to jail at the same level of intensity as our precious poor brothers and sisters, disproportionately chocolate, that'd be a town hall meeting every week. It'd be on ABC, NBC, MSNBC, maybe even Fox News would have to carry it. Let's just tell the truth. The condition of truth is always to allow suffering to speak, just like the love is always connected to justice. Justice is what love looks like in public, just like tenderness is what love feels like in private. And I come from a people, and Sister Barbara knows what I'm talking about. I come from a people who've been terrorized, traumatized, and stigmatized for 400 years, but we still understand what it is to stand up for justice and still connect it to a radical tenderness and a militant gentleness and a subversive sweetness, even as we're willing to live and die for the cause of justice. That is what is necessary now. Thank God for Sister Michelle Alexander in her text, The New Jim Crow. Thank God for Angela Davis on the front line for over 40 years. Thank God for Glenn Lowry. Thank God for Mumia Abu-Jamal on the front for over 30-some years. Oh, give all of our political prisoners who have suffered indescribably a hand. Just give them a hand. Let's just stop this moment. We'll never forget your sacrifice. No matter how much they're abused, we'll never forget what they stood up for. I see Brother Larry Mamiya in the crowd from Vassar. He wrote the great text on the history of the black freedom struggle filtered through the black church. Well, we are here because we want to make the connection between the Jim Crow Jr., the new Jim Crow, which is the prison industrial complex, to the Wall Street oligarchic complex, where 1% of the population owned 42% of the wealth, where 40% of our precious red children, brown children, black children live in poverty, where 22% of all of our precious children live in poverty in the richest nation of the history of the world. That is morally obscene and spiritually profane. There's a connection between wrestling with these issues and wrestling with what Martin Luther King Jr. gave his life at the end, connecting the eradicating poverty with the military industrial complex, the imperial policies. When we talk about the precious lives of our young people here, we have to connect it to the children who have been murdered by the U.S. government with drones dropping bombs on them. 223 and counting. No serious public discussion about it. A nation loses whatever soul that it has if it thinks that somehow it can be callous and indifferent when it comes to the suffering of anybody. I don't care what color, I don't care what country, I don't care what civilization, I don't care what sexual orientation, I don't care what ethnicity. Oh yes, and that's the tradition that I come out of. Yeah, that's the tradition of Curtis Mayfield and Nina Simone. That's the tradition of Sly Stone. They told us to stand. There's a cross for us to bear, things to go through if you go in anything. Stand. There's a midget standing tall and the giant beside him about to fall. Oh, yes. And what we're doing here today, we stand together. Just look at each other. Look at how beautiful you are. Do you know what it means when you coalesce of something bigger than you? You get beyond just your skin pigmentation and your sexual orientation. You start talking about something deep like your humanity, like your morality, like your integrity, like your honesty, like your decency. We want to be a movement of virtue that says in the face of institutionalized vice that we're willing to pay the price and bear the burden. And that's why we here in New York State, and those of us who come from the East Coast, even though I'm from California, I'm a West Coast brother, we want to be on the cutting edge. When we heard Brother Hayden lay it out and talking about Attica and the Attica laws that tried to so oftentimes render so many of our precious folk invisible. We have to make the connection between the poverty on the one hand, the legacy of white supremacy and male supremacy and anti-Jewish hatred and anti-Arab hatred and anti-Muslim hatred and homophobia all together, but also connected to the oligarchs and the plutocrats, the big banks and the big corporations who get off with impunity. It is no accident that not one Wall Street executive has gone to jail, given all the criminality on Wall Street in the last 5 years with market manipulation and insider trading and fraudulent activity. We've got to have a holistic view on this thing. Oh, yeah. My dear brother Carl Dixon, so good to see you. Always good to see you. We went to jail together for stop and frisk. We now got to stopped mass incarceration, now having a call in October. Give Brother Carl a hand. Give our dear brother a hand. Love you, Brother Carl. But I'm going to sit down because it's time to move to our artists. And when it comes to struggling against injustice, the arts are not ornamental or decorative. They are integral and constitutive of who we are. If you get your music right, if you get your poetry right, if you get your language right, you can get your spirit right. And if you get your spirit right, you can straighten your back up. And for so long, we've been walking around humped over. Brother Martin used to say, anytime those Sly Stone called everyday people walk around hunched over, you're not going anywhere. But oh, when you straighten your backs up, when you hold hands together, when you organize, bring your organization with somebody else's organization so you don't have to have organizational envy. No, we fighting for not one organization. We fighting for a cause. It's called justice. It's called fairness. It's called equality. And in the end, it's called radical democracy. Thank you all for being here. This is just the first step. This is just the first step of where we going with this.
And that was Cornel West from the May 5th Albany Rally for Prison Justice. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM in Hudson, New York. And this is the Prison Voices Project. I'm your host this morning, Karanja K. Takaro. Today's show covers highlights and takeaways from a selection of our 2014 broadcast. So far, we have heard clips from our January 23rd show on parole justice, along with the previous excerpts from the May 5th Albany Rally for Prison Justice. Let's take a break from the clips and listen to De La Soul and Chuck D's The People.
We are the ones left to make do with the two hands the good Lord gave us. With no resources and thrown to the forces that be, with no one to save us. The ones in the classroom where the books are outdated, teacher no longer outspoken. The ones left to congregate where the pusher gives a fix to those who had their dreams broken. The ones left to drown and rebuild the towns in the path of the waters from the levees. The ones with the problems of the world that they back, but make light of the fact that the weight is getting heavy. We are the ones who have daughters and sons who commit themselves to having unsafe nights. The ones who lost family in 9/11 hours after telling them to have a safe flight. We are the ones. We are the. We are the. We are the. We are the ones. We are the. We are the. We are the. We be the soul, the human core, the planet whose blood, sweat, and tears even we take for granted. We the ones separated by waters and international borders only to take government orders. We are the ones with the same childhood dreams, but adulthood brings nightmares and screams. We be the raw excuse to slang, I mean, we the people they stereotype for gangs. Who sold the sea for our daughters and sons withstand the infiltration of drugs and guns. We are the ones that kneel to the young with a heart of gold to avoid being victimized by our sons. We be the ones trying to raise them into all man brothers, not some whipping posts from coast to coast. We are the people run down, lied to, cried to, still they depend on our culture to live and dance to. We are the people, still the wretched of the earth. At the end of God's day, we persevere through the hurt. We are the ones, we are the. We are the. We are the. Come on, Michael. Make up for the Masala. We the people at the fish fry. We the 86% with heart disease. Gucci, Louis Vuitton, Nike shoes wearing, no banking accounts. No misbehaving, catching the blame. Same old, same lotto players. Looking to Obama for deliverance. But ever since they popped Malcolm and Martin, we at the front of the bus now, pouting. Complaints ain't nothing but a lazy man's sofa. The CEO's gopher's gopher. We're the video hostess hoe. We're emotional. But if we peep shit, I'm thinking we supposed to roll. But we the same lying, cheating, backstabbing. We part of our own struggle. We would burst our neighbor's bubble. Destined to meet the maker, but at the same time be the same people late for his arrival. Yo, a false survival. No longer feeling tribal. And as much as it makes me feel good to say that we are beautiful people, there's a lot of us messing it up for the people. We are the. We are the.
And that was De La Soul and Chuck D, The People. Our last clip from our 2014 season comes from an interview conducted by myself and Alexandra Cox. On July 10th, we interviewed Deborah Small, executive director of Break the Chains, who gave an important analysis of the terms mass incarceration and mass criminalization, along with discussing the politics of racially based prison justice. Alexandra shared with me your article, Cause for Trepidation, Libertarians' Newfound Concern for Prison Reform. And that pretty much shapes some of the questions that we wanted to talk through with you and have you expand on some insight. So I guess if we could start with you trying to explain why you introduced the concept of mass criminalization as a way to understand the current discourse on crime and punishment.
Well, so let me just start by saying that I've been in the criminal justice reform field for a long time, about 15 years now. And one of the things that I've noticed is that we tend to have cycles of work that focus around the issue of the day. So, for example, 6 or 7 years ago, or maybe even 10 years ago when Bush was in office, well, even going further, when I first came into the field, the issue of the day was drug courts. Mm-hmm. They were the new reform that everyone was embracing as a way that was going to correct some of the problems of the justice system. Then a few years later, when Bush came into office, it was reentry was the issue in vogue because he was concerned about reentry issues. And so the whole field became focused on doing reentry work. And even though we didn't do anything to change the policies that acted as barriers to people, we had all kinds of work focused on making it easier and developing more programs for people coming back from prison, etc. So then when Michelle Alexander's book came out, which I happen to think is brilliant, the new issue of the day has become mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. And so now the same people who focused on drug courts before and then reentry are now talking about mass incarceration. Each of those issues are legitimate, and each of them are an important part of the problem that that's, you know, posed by the prison industrial complex. But they don't, to me, represent a sufficient frame for talking about policy reform and what it is that people who were concerned about changing institutions as opposed to fixing people should be thinking about and focused on. Mm-hmm. And so my major problem with mass incarceration is two things. One, as a word, it's problematic because it suggests, as a phrase, that somehow there's some level of incarceration that's okay before you get to mass incarceration. So I mean, because I also have issues, like, just as a wordsmithy person. Okay. So I have a problem with from that point of view, in the same way that I have a problem with the term majority minority, which is an oxymoron from my point of view that we should never use. So, you know, just as a person who cares about terminology, I don't like us to use that frame because it implies within it something that undermines the very thing that we say that we're trying to do. So that's the first thing.
Okay.
Secondly, is that it's like stop and frisk, which is only one small part of racially biased policing. So if you only focus on one small thing, which may be a big thing, but it's like the thread of a sweater. You can pull out a thread and you can make a hole in the sweater, but you still got a sweater. You just got a sweater with a lot of holes in it.
Right.
So to me, it's like the problem with mass incarceration is that it's focusing on the tail end of a long process, a process that for many people starts when they're children. So the reason that I prefer or use the phrase mass criminalization is because, one, to me, it's a more accurate term of what it is that we're doing, which is criminalizing large masses of people and doing it at very early stages. And not all of that criminalization results in people ending up in prison, but it does end up in them having some level of criminal justice contact or supervision, whether it's in the form of surveillance or a police arrest or their interaction with the family court or the child welfare system or the public public assistance system. I mean, there are all of these ways in which we have made it somewhat criminal for people to be poor, because that their very status of being poor subjects them to surveillance and intrusions on their life by the state that would never be tolerated by other people. And so to me, that's criminalization. If you have to surrender your urine as a condition to get money to feed your children or to pay your rent, then that's treating you like a criminal, because we don't do that to people who want to take a tax break on their mortgage.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, or get any number of other benefits that we regularly bestow on middle class people. Mm-hmm. And we would never think of subjecting them to that. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't even do it to the elderly as a condition before they could ride on the, you know, elderly assisted bus for transportation or to get meals on wheels or whatever. But we feel like it's okay to do it to poor people because, one, we assume that the majority of them are people of color. Mm-hmm. And two, we know that whether they are or not, they're people without power.
Right.
And because of the particular system that we live in, which is class-based but in denial about it, everyone wants to have someone to look down on. So we focus our attention in terms of where we are down as opposed to up. You know, when we're looking for a scapegoat, we look for someone down as opposed to up. And one of the basic values of being poor in the U.S. is that, well, at least I'm not undocumented, you know, or at least I'm not behind bars. You know, there's always some other group that's going to have a little bit more stigma and a little less privileges and liberties than you that you can look down on. And that's a big part of, unfortunately, our country's identity, because we spend a lot of time focusing and obsessing about that.
And how do you think the criminal justice reform movement may have suffered by relying on the framework of mass incarceration?
Well, so I don't know if I would say suffer, mm-hmm. because a suffering implies that you would have gotten somewhere otherwise if you didn't. Mm. And, you know, I don't know that that's true. You know, our ability to move any issue is very, very limited, because ultimately these things aren't really about crime. They're really more about economic and social control under the guise of crime control. Because if we were really focused on crime, we would care as much about white collar crime and the kind of crime that costs people millions and billions as we do the crimes that cost thousands. So I'm not convinced that this has much to do with crime at all. That being said, I think that the particular problem that the justice field faces, which is the same problem that the progressive community in general in America faces, is the overall unwillingness to deal with issues around racism and issues around capitalism. And that's not the same thing as talking about race, which mm-hmm. we'll talk about, but that's not the same as talking about racism and white privilege, mm-hmm. nor do we really want to deal with talking about capitalism, because people feel that they don't have a viable working alternative to it, so therefore they don't feel they can talk about it, which I find amazing, because it never stops the right. They make all the most preposterous stuff, and it never bothers them that there's no factual basis for it whatsoever, or any example that their version of democratic rule could work anywhere, but they put it out there anyhow. So, you know, and I'm not saying that, you know, a discussion about capitalism is the equivalent to that. But what I am saying is that because we tend to be ahistorical in our country, we forget that most of the major progressive gains in the U.S. for the majority of people were accompanied by a critique of the overall economic system, whether they were called critiques of capitalism or not. So both critiques of slavery, critiques of that led to the labor movement, to the women's movement, all talked about the inequality of the economic structure and the hierarchical nature of the economic structure and the way in which it unjustly enriched a small percentage of the people at the expense of everybody else. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't include that in our education anymore, but that doesn't make it any less true. And so for me, not seeing the role that criminal justice plays in maintaining that ongoing relationship of power and economic distribution in society means that you're actually missing the ball game.
I think, you know, piggybacking off of Alexander's question and getting at a point that you stated in the previous response, I'm curious to know, you know, what do you think are the pros and cons of Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow? Obviously, it kind of pushed forward this language of mass incarceration, and it also shaped, you know, certain discussions within criminal justice as it relates to reform. But are there any other pros and cons that you think generate out of that text and its popularity?
See, I don't blame her book for the frame that people are using. Her book is a book, and the title is the title. I think it's a perfect title for her book. Mm. I blame the field for using the title as a frame for doing policy work.
Mm. Okay.
That's on us. That's not on her.
Okay.
You know, any more than it's on us to be obsessed with marijuana reform, as if that was the most important issue in drug policy reform.
Okay.
Or to forget about the international aspects of the war on drugs and only focus on what happens in the U.S. borders. Mm-hmm. All I'm saying, and that's a lot in one sentence, responsive to what you said. But my point, basically, is that, one, I think her book is an excellent book. That everything that she set out to do in the book, she accomplished. Okay?
Okay.
So no one book should be the basis of any social or political movement.
Correct.
No one book should be the basis for determining a policy frame for moving forward around any complex set of social justice issues. So for me, you know, I don't have any critiques of her book.
Okay.
I wish she had gone further in terms of giving some for solutions, you know, that get to the heart of the need to dismantle drug prohibition. But the fact that she wasn't there when she wrote the book, I don't fault her for that either. I think that any time that you can forward a conversation that opens people's eyes about an issue that they need to be educated about, I think that that is a positive thing. And if you can do that in a way that communicates to a popular audience of people, I think that that's also great. I don't want to say academic because I'm not an academic. My analytical policy frame critique of the book, and it's not of the book, really. It's of the reception to the book and the way in which it's been interpreted. And one of the reasons that it's popular is that, for me, I believe that one of the reasons that it struck a chord and is become popular and a bestseller, aside from the fact that it provides a lot of good information, is that it also tells a story that America is comfortable with. Mm. A story of Black victimology, a story of racial oppression and discrimination. And quite frankly, in and of itself, it's not a particularly empowering story. Mm. And it's a story that white people can read and get educated about and feel good about themselves, because now they know about something that they didn't know about before, as if they had no complicity in the reality of the condition that she's talking about.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I don't blame her or the book for that. I think that that's the context in which most conversations about race take place in America. That they, it's a comfortable space. Mm-hmm. White people are willing. And for that, progress is we're now willing to accept the fact that we've done really bad things to Black people over the years and to feel bad about it. Mm-hmm. And for them, that represents progress. And to say that we're going to try not to do those same things again.
Mm.
and in the American context, that represents racial progress.
And that was Alexandra Cox and myself interviewing Deborah Small from Break the Chains. And we will now move on to our last musical selection, which is Lauryn Hill's Black Rage.
Black Rage is founded on 2/3 a person. Rapings and beatings and suffering that worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on blatant denial, squeezed economics, subsistence survival, deafening silence and social control. Black rage is founded on wounds in the soul. When the dogs bite, when the bees sting, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I don't fear so bad. Black rage is founded, fed us self-hatred, lies and abuse while we waited and waited. Spiritual treason, this grid and its cages. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things. All these kinds of things, and then I don't fear so.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM in Hudson, New York. And that was Lauryn Hill's Black Rage. And I'm your host, Karanja K. Takaro. That brings a close to our 2014 excerpts, clips, and segments. 2014 was a good year for the Prison Voices Project, and we look forward to a prosperous 2015. Happy New Year!
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, second floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I'm
say hey.